Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 136 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, that is Gavin and Fia. And guys, you ever been hit in the head?
Yes. You know, I have. It's been a long time. But so one of my first teeth that the guy I got knocked out was from, I was at a soccer camp when I was like, I don't know, however old you are when you lose teeth. Although this tooth was not ready to come out, I got...
You sound like that uncle that's like not qualified to take care of the little nieces and nephews.
But it's myself.
Like, yeah, how old are you? Right. What are you, six? You driving yet?
Yeah, however old children are when they lose teeth. But like I said, this tooth was not ready to come out. It was not loose. I got smoked in the face with a soccer ball by a senior when I was, like I said, maybe six or seven. And okay. Full on knocked one of my front teeth out, which is the worst because when it's not loose, it's not like the other one's right there to come in. I was down a front tooth for like months.
A while.
Yeah. Yep. Anywho, Mike. Yeah,
Fia, do you have a story?
Yeah.
Same, but with a volleyball, I didn't lose a tooth and I was in college.
I can imagine volleyball getting like, that thing's got to be going hard.
Yeah. It really hurt. It really hurt. It was right in my forehead.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun. I got hit in the head on April Fool's Day. Yeah, April Fool's Day 2024 got absolutely rocked. When I say absolutely rocked, didn't think it was absolutely rocked.
So a quick interruption. Last episode, I had mentioned Mike wasn't here because he's going to have a fun war story for us next time he joins. This is said war story.
So it was, I mean, I'll give you the short version here because I'm sure that this doesn't make for great radio. But the short story is there's a giant Donnybrook at school, six kids at the high school, okay? Like it's, you know, they're grown men, essentially. And I'm right there as it's starting. So I'm, you know, trying to be good cop, like, hey, let's not fight, guys. Let's all get along. Didn't work, as you might imagine. And as I'm right in the fight starts, I catch one to the back of the head. Fight continues going on. Six kids wind up getting in on this. So every time we have one or two of them back, a third or a fourth one comes flying in. We got people on the ground. It was wild. Eventually, after I think it was 3.5 minutes is what we were told, we get things cleaned up. Look at my hand. My hand's bleeding. I go to the nurse, we get it wiped up. Turns out it's not just a scratch mark, but I got bit on the hand.
Oh my gosh.
Yikes.
I was bit. So I go, I teach my next class. My administration then finds me, sends me home, and they're like, you need to not be here right now. yeah, and I thought that I got a little hit to the head and it wasn't that bad. And I'd be fine. Turns out concussed. Turns out still concussed. We're recording this.
A month.
April 28th.
Yeah, close to a month later.
Yeah, this is going to go out on the 1 month anniversary of, you know, the rumble in the hallway. And tell you what, I don't enjoy being concussed. First time this has happened to me.
Yeah, he texts us. I text everybody. I was like, hey, are we still good to record at whatever time we record? And Mike was like, I don't know. I think I'll be there. I can't see currently.
Yeah.
And Fia and I were like, what? What do you mean? What do you mean you can't see? It was like the Jennifer Lawrence Hot Ones meme. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean? But
just like, oh, like that, this was, you're talking about today, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like an hour. So like, I'm feeling good today. I was doing stuff. I was doing things like normally. Like I'm feeling normal. Then all of a sudden, you know, I get home, you know, hour and a half before the podcast, you know, we start recording. And all of a sudden, these little like pockets of my vision just turn into like little swirlies, and I can't focus. So we got ourselves a problem here, boys. Fia, I'm including you and the boys.
Yeah. Thanks.
As you should.
And yeah, so like I got these blue light glasses, which have the side benefit of making me look like reasonably smart.
Oh yeah.
That's why that's an underrated reason why I wear mine.
Yep.
It really does. It really does something.
I put them on. I looked in the mirror. And I was like, damn, like, I'd buy insurance from that guy. so we're going to do a podcast here, and Gavin's going to say some smart stuff, and Fee is going to ask some interesting questions, and I'm going to try and make sure that my vision. You're always going to say some smart stuff.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think Mike's going to have more to add to this episode than at least he usually thinks he does.
Considering this is one of the few times I know what the topic is, I might, but even still, like, I got to make sure my vision doesn't do that thing where it gets like all crossy
just
for no
close
reason.
Your eyes.
As one
like
does.
You know, you know when you're kind of staring off into space and all of a sudden, like, your vision goes kind of
sure.
Like, you get kind of cross-eyed, but you get just too lazy to actually, like, fix it. Yeah. Like, that's how I feel sometimes, but, like, I'll try and fix it, and it doesn't go. yeah. So, fortunately, this is an audio medium, so I think I'll be able to live. But we'll see. Like, this could be a wild one.
Yeah. All right. Well, with
yeah.
that fun.
Yeah, so that's where we're at.
Yeah, that's where we're at. With that fun.
Yeah, happy podcast, everybody.
Vietnam story. Yeah, six minutes into the podcast, and we're getting into the opening.
6 minutes in.
We're getting into the opening segments of the podcast. I love it.
That's absurd that we're 6 minutes into the podcast. We need some quality control here.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about the Smithsonian today. I'm really excited about it. But before we get into the actual main topic of the episode, Fia, can you do some housekeeping for us?
Of course. As you know, don't forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on and to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. And give us feedback about the show and any future topics you would like to hear on the pod. And if you would like to be a guest on the show, be sure to fill out the guest form. All that good stuff can be found in the show notes. What is next episode topic, Gavin?
Yeah, next episode we're going to be talking about a cool group of animals. I feel like we don't talk enough about birds on this podcast. We've had a couple of different episodes about birds. I know we had one about like ostriches and other big birds and stuff, and I think that might be the only like dedicated like group of birds episode we've done. But we're going to be talking about hawks and eagles because cool. It's a really interesting, really cool group of birds that includes a lot of things that you might not think, and also excludes a lot of things that you probably think should be in there but are not. Yeah, so that's going to be next episode in a couple weeks. And with that, we'll turn to our resident U.S. history teacher and concussed human. Mike, what happened today in history?
Yeah, so baseball.
Sure.
What's an exciting thing that happens in baseball?
Home run.
A perfect game.
So you got home runs. Home runs are exciting, okay? Something not a home run. In fact, it doesn't even involve swinging a bat. What's something that it's exciting in a baseball game, doesn't involve swinging a bat?
Doesn't involve swinging a bat?
Yes.
Kiss cam.
Kiss cam? Okay. Correct. This is something that's on the field. So it's something the players are doing.
Okay.
Yes.
Pitching?
Not pitching, although good guess.
Catching.
Not catching.
Oh, pickles.
You're so close.
What?
A pickle when you get stuck in.
Yeah, when you get. Yeah, pickles when you get, like, you're caught off the bag and, like, you got to run back and forth and try and.
Oh, okay.
Not get tagged.
I stopped playing baseball in, like, fifth grade.
There's one thing I know you guys both know this. What's a way you can try and get from one base to the next?
Stealing.
Oh, stealing.
Yes, stealing a base. Okay. One of the most exciting plays in baseball. And. One dude who is the all-time record holder. Do either of you two know who holds the record for most stolen bases all time?
No.
If it's somebody even sort of recent, like within the last 5 to 10 years, no.
It is not. It is a guy named Ricky Henderson.
No, never heard of him.
So on today's date, May 1st, 1991, Ricky Henderson broke the record for most steals all time. And Ricky Henderson was just such an alien. I'm going to read you the top 5 stolen base numbers of all time.
Okay.
Today. So you've got Tim Raines with 808, Ty Cobb with 897, Billy Hamilton with 914. That is old Billy Hamilton, not for any baseball fans, the more recent Billy Hamilton. Lou Brock is second all time at 938. So we go from 808 to 938, 5 through 2.
Okay.
And then Ricky Henderson has 1,406.
Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
He is right. It's one of those things where, like, he is so far ahead of the next highest person, in this particular skill. It is kind of remarkable.
Yeah, that's crazy.
He was also just, a really interesting guy. He would always talk in the third person about himself. Like, you know, Ricky's going to go 4-for-4 today. And just, you can watch some videos of Ricky Henderson.
Who did he play for?
And it is, he played for a whole lot of teams. I believe he swiped that bag when he was playing for the Oakland Athletics.
Okay.
But he's one of those guys that played for 1,000 teams. The Athletics, the Yankees, the Athletics again, the Blue Jays, Athletics again, Padres, Angels, Athletics again, Mets, Mariners, Padres, Red Sox, and Dodgers.
Okay.
So he was all around. He's a very fun baseball player. And one of the most exciting of all time. And that's what happened on Today in History. And even though I'm concussed, I did remember that Fia's up next.
Thanks.
With Seagrass Corner.
Yeah, our resident, you remember.
Marine ecologist.
Yes.
Cool. Welcome to Seagrass Corner, guys. Today we're going to talk about a group of fish called Ostraceidae. Ostraceidae, probably. Gavin, you got
that looks right.
Okay.
That might. I'm not. Depending on if it's Greek or Latin, that might be a hard C. But close enough.
Yeah. Well, anyways, this is a family of squared bony fish, closely related to the pufferfish and filefish. These fish are also known as boxfish, cofferfishes, cowfish, or trunkfish. They are so cute. There are about 23 existing species under 6 genera. And basically, yeah, they kind of look like pufferfish, but a little more square. And a little more like, it's like if a pufferfish was like anorexic, kind of like lost a little weight. It's like a little skeleton-like. But yeah,
okay.
They come in a variety of different colors and are notable for like hexagonal or honeycomb pattern. There's one particular called the honeycomb cowfish, which I think is a cool name. But yeah, they have these hexagonal plate-like scales that are fused together into a solid box-like body. And then they have their little fins, tail, eyes, and mouth that come out of the box. And basically, because they are so thick-scaled, they're heavily armored, it makes them kind of slow-moving. But it's okay because there are a few fish that are really able to eat the adults. And even another like defense mechanism, some of the genuses in the boxfishes are able to secrete poisons from their skin into the surrounding water, and that further protects them from getting eaten.
I guess that makes sense if they're related to pufferfish.
Yeah, so basically they secrete some of them, not all of them, but some families secrete cationic surfactants through their skin, which can act as a chemical defense mechanism. And these surfactants are diffused into the water and quickly surround the fish, and it can make a negative impact to any other fish around and be like, oh, I need to leave. And these toxins kind of resemble certain detergents to the point where adding these detergents as pollutants into seawater has the potential to interfere with these receptor-mediated processes in marine life.
Huh.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
So basically, cowfish are boxes that secrete laundry detergent.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's just a box full of soapy fish.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for that. Yeah, thanks for that, Sophia. That was neat. And I did look them up. They are very cute.
They're so cute.
And however boxy you think they are, they're more. Awesome. So yeah, with that, let's get into sort of the main topic of the episode, the Smithsonian. And so we've had a whole episode about a couple different museums. So we had one where we had a guest on and we talked about the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. But we also had episode 73, where we talked about the American Museum of Natural History. And despite its name, the American Museum of Natural History in New York City is not the National Museum of the United States.
Dang.
It's a very misleading name. And so today, what we're technically talking about is the National Museum of Natural History, more commonly just called the Smithsonian. When most people, especially people that I know, talk about the Smithsonian, they're probably referring to the Natural History Museum. But well, as we'll talk about, there is so much more sort of under the large umbrella that is the Smithsonian. So we'll talk about some of the other things, but we'll focus a lot on the Natural History Museum itself. But yeah, so a couple quick things just about the Smithsonian in general, and then a couple of things, quick facts about the Natural History Museum. Firstly, it's free. Please go to it if you're ever in DC. There are many museums that are not free, but it's paid for with taxpayer dollars. If you're in DC, it is one of the coolest free things you can go do. And there's a lot of really cool free stuff to do in DC because it's paid for with your taxes. It's open 364 days a year. I'm pretty sure Christmas is the one day off, I think. But every other day of the year, it's open. Last year, 2023, it had 4.4 million visitors. And is one of the top three most visited museums in the country, only behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the American Museum of Natural History. And those are probably only higher because it's in New York City.
Right.
The building itself, the main building of the Natural History Museum, is over 1.5 million square feet. It is an enormous building.
Wow.
But only about 325,000 square feet is public facing. So not, you know, what is that? 20% of it, give or take, is public facing. The rest of it is all the goodies and stuff that they keep for research. And so the main reason the Smithsonian is so awesome, though, is that it has over 146 million specimens of plants, fossils, animals, fungi, water samples, minerals, rocks, human remains, touchy subject, cultural artifacts, also very touchy subject. And for comparison, the American Museum of Natural History in New York has about 32 million specimens.
Jeez.
Compared to 146 million.
Jeez. I sense a winner.
Yeah. And also for... You know, and those are like the two premier museums in the country. A much more typical museum, like the one I worked at in South Dakota, the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology Museum, that's where I went to grad school, has somewhere in the ballpark of 900,000 to 1.1 million. So, which is a lot of stuff.
But right, still plenty, like you're doing okay there.
Yeah. This is an absolutely insane amount of specimens. It's by far the largest collection in the world, and it's second place is not even close.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, something else really cool that they have that no one else has, it's home to a science staff of around 180, 190 researchers and assistants, which is also the largest natural history research staff of any museum in the world. And this covers everything.
The largest?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Dedicated like just to natural history. So obviously some like universities probably have a larger academic staff. But for natural history specifically, you know, almost 200, you know, PhD researchers and, you know, various assistant and technical staff. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question based on that, but I assume you're going to cover it soon, so I'm going to hold my question and quite likely forget my question.
Okay.
I think you're going to get there.
So, yes, please, for the love of God, if you are ever in D.C., please go to this museum. Just for the Fossil Hall alone, if you're interested enough in paleontology to be listening to a podcast like this, you're going to love it. It was renovated in 2019, and so I got to see it last March, and I've... this is saying something for me. I only found like a thing or two to sort of grab out where it's like, that's not technically correct. Or like, just because like the taxonomy has changed or something like that, where it's like no museum can hope to keep up with the constantly updating taxonomy. That's not like that much of a critique. But like, because it's so new, it is, they have the coolest exhibits possible, which is something that like really only something funded by the federal government can do.
Gavin, a noob question here.
Yeah.
How much does it cost to go to the Smithsonian?
It's free.
Yes, that's what I love about so much of Washington, D.C., and so many of the museums in Washington, D.C. They are free. You just show up there during regular operating hours, and, like, you're good to go. It is – I could talk about – I love D.C. I could talk about D.C. all day long. There's a million museums that are worth going to. And I remember when I went to the Natural History Museum, and it's, like – it really is incredible. Even if like you're not a super sciencey person, like you don't have to be.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a super history person to go to the, you know, the history ones, right? Like it really is incredible stuff that's really well done.
Yeah. I could spend like, if you were to go to just the Smithsonian things, not the various other museums, you could easily fill like 2 weeks. I think fairly easily. Just there's so much to do. And so here we'll talk about just quickly about the rest of the Smithsonian and the things in there as well. So the Smithsonian Institution is the technical name of it. Smithsonian Institution. It's sort of a large collection of, I saw different numbers on different websites, somewhere around 21 different museums, art galleries, and also a zoo. Here's just a few of them. There's the National Air and Space Museum, National Museum of American History, the National Zoo, National Museum of African American History and Culture, the American...
I've not been to that one, unfortunately.
No, me either. The American Art Museum, the National Museum of the American Indian.
That one is also a really interesting one.
Yeah. National Museum of Asian Art, the National Postal Museum.
Wait, there's a National Postal Museum?
There sure is.
Oh. Tell you what, Gavin, you keep doing your little talky-talk thing on the podcast. I'm going to be doing some research. I'm not going to listen to a whole lot of what you're saying for the next couple of minutes.
Okay, well, you should listen to this next part. And also, of course, the National Museum of Natural History. And just as a quick side note, my wonderful wife, Liz, used to work for the Smithsonian.
Wait, she, what?
Yeah, she worked at one of their sites in Virginia, taking care of animals in their sort of endangered species breeding facilities out near Shenandoah National Park.
When did Gavin's wife live in Virginia?
I don't remember. Like, it was while she was in college. She like did a summer internship there. I don't remember the year though.
It's incredible.
Okay. Liz.
She also. Yeah, I'm. I just love hyping up my wife. I love her.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a wife guy. She also went to Panama on a trip with the Smithsonian through for a different program. Like I said, I'm just real proud and love hyping up my wife. So go her.
Shout out Liz if you're listening.
Yes. So yes, now Mike, you can go search the Postal Museum.
This is. Oh my God. Oh my God. This is incredible.
Yeah, right? Everything about the Smithsonian is so cool. And especially, wait till I talk about sort of some of the history of the Smithsonian itself. We'll get there.
I believe I have a piece of trivia about the Smithsonian, but I want to double check it before I get something wrong. So you keep, do your thing.
Sure. So throughout this episode, I'm going to be here and there comparing the Smithsonian to the American Museum, the one in New York, quite a lot. They're, like I said, sort of the two premier museums in the country. Lots of other great ones, not trying to shortchange them, but when it comes to history and just the sheer volume of stuff that they have, these two are pretty much far and away the largest and some of the oldest in North America in general. So I'll be talking about the American Museum a decent amount. That American Museum, New York. Smithsonian or National Museum, D.C. The establishment of the Smithsonian as an institution is a very, very American story with lots of famous names from American history involved, many of which you've probably heard of. Depending on how you sort of define the start of the Smithsonian. It sort of traced itself back to the 1810s. So shortly after the War of 1812, Britain tried to come in and take over America again. We said no. They burned down the White House. It's fine.
That's a hell of a way to talk about the beginning of the War of 1812, but okay. I'll let it slide for now.
As far as I understand, that's kind of right. It's right enough for this podcast.
Okay.
And yeah, so at the time, 1810s, it was basically an attempt at collecting and generating information that can be used in a practical way to sort of help build the U.S. as a nation. And I specifically say practical there because as much as I love them, these days, many museums preserve things simply for posterity's sake, and it's not necessarily the most practical. But at the time, the U.S. was still like less than 50 years old. So they were focused on, you know, doing things that could help them build into the empire that the United States would become. And so things like researching improved farming practices, expanding and improving our maps of North America and the rest of the world, finding mineral deposits, stuff like that, that have like very practical uses to a young nation. And so it basically started off with a bunch of dudes thinking, hey, we should have some dedicated organization whose job it is to do this type of stuff. Those dudes are very famous for other things, namely being presidents or otherwise really important in the American Revolution. Among the people who were associated to some degree with the founding of what would later become the Smithsonian are John Quincy Adams, notable genocide promoter Andrew Jackson, James Madison, James Monroe, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Marquis de Lafayette, some various other members of Congress, judges, and famous architects at the time. Basically, the cast of Hamilton that were still alive in the 1810s. So they formed this organization, which at the time was called the Columbian Institute for the Promotion of Arts and Sciences. Not sure why Columbia? Unsure. So they formed that in 1816, and it received a formal charter from Congress in 1818. It didn't really have like a formal home, though, so it just kind of bounced around from, you know, federal agency to federal agency. It was housed in the Treasury Department for a while, in the City Hall of Washington, D.C. for a little bit, and then eventually was given its own space in the Capitol building in 1824. And initially, they actually had weekly meetings with Congress where they shared the research that they were doing with members of Congress. I wish that was still the case, to be honest. But yeah. they ended up stopping that, doing that every week because people stopped showing up.
Aww.
Yeah. Science has never been loved, even 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So though the folks that, you know, created this this Columbian Institute had big goals, they never really kind of got off the ground. Even though they got the congressional charter, they didn't really get much congressional funding. And so the only things that they did that sort of lasted a long time were the botanical gardens, which are still where they are today, where the National Botanical Garden still sits, and formally creating a publicly open museum. That was not common at the time. Public-facing museums are, all things considered, a relatively new thing. So this was one of the first, not just a collection for people to look, for like researchers to look at, but something that is public facing that regular people can come in and look at the stuff. And so the museum had typical museum sorts of things. It's kind of hard to say exactly what it looked like because at this point it's sort of the late 1820s to 1830s. So there's not a ton of photographs. I don't even think photography had really been invented in the 20s and 30s. So there's not great records of what was on display or how it was displayed. The word paleontology was not coined until 1822, and the word dinosaur wasn't coined until 1841. So the word dinosaur did not exist at this time. So it's kind of hard to say what kind of information they had at this
time. Were dinosaurs known about at this time?
Yes and no. They knew there were some kind of large reptile that was clearly not around anymore.
Okay.
But as for, like, none of like the larger groups of dinosaurs were named. I think there was like a handful of dinosaur species named, but they were like, oh, just a big lizard, I guess. So it wasn't until the early or like late 1830s into the 1840s when they were like, okay, this is like an actual group, not just like a weird one or two off doing their thing. Mm-hmm. So like I said, that was through the 20s and 30s, 1820s and 30s. And however, the congressional charter for the Institute only lasted 20 years. So it expired in 1838. So at this point, that Columbian Institute, gone. It is no longer like congressionally approved. So most of the items that the Institute had collected, they were transferred to an other, more different organization called the National Institute for Promotion of Science a few years later. From what I could tell, this was basically just a lobbying group that, you know, was advocating for basically all the things that the Columbian Institute was trying to do. Museums, collecting stuff in nature and studying stuff about nature. But like a lobbying group instead of like a congressionally approved thing. Politics never changes, man.
So
this new institute was basically the repository for all the things that the United States government was collecting on all these various expeditions around, you know, the rest of North America as the United States sort of expanded west, as well as a lot of different expeditions in the 1830s and 40s from like the Pacific side of Asia and lots of different Pacific islands. They were just going out and pillaging a ton of stuff. So they brought it back, and this institute was sort of where all of that was collected. So that's from 18 teens up to like the early-ish 1840s. So why the heck is it called the Smithsonian? Where does that come from? So while all of this stuff was happening, America was doing its typical, you know, colonization stuff, stealing from the locals. And in 1829, a British scientist named James Smithson died. That's all you need to know about him. He died. James Smithson.
Okay.
He was considerably wealthy. He was a very well-known British scientist. And he left his considerable wealth to his nephew, Henry James Hungerford, who is also notably not American. And there was a pretty significant catch in Smithson's will. He basically said that if Hungerford were to die without having children to leave the money to, then all of the money should be given, quote, to the United States of America to found at Washington under the name of the Smithsonian Institute, an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men, unquote. So, 6 years later, after having no children, that guy also died. I have so many questions about this. None of them are answered. Neither of these two people were American. From what I could tell, neither of them ever even visited America at all. There's basically no information about the nephew kind of anywhere online. His Wikipedia page redirects to the Smithsonian's page. Sure.
Okay. Don't you love that, like, link rot over time?
Yeah. So I have no idea. I don't even know how old Hungerford was when he died, having no kids. I in my head, though, Smithson was kind of a mean person. And he saw his nephew was like 65 with no kids. And he's like, I'll give you this money, but you can't use it unless you have kids. And he's like, no, knowing full well, he's too old to have kids. He's like, ah. But why they gave it to the U.S. government in the first place, as far as I know, that's kind of a mystery. We don't know.
Yeah, seems so.
Okay.
Yeah. And so after very much red tape, the money did eventually get to the United States in 1838. At the time, it was $500,000, thereabout. And so keep in mind, that's 1838 money. How much that is today depends kind of how you calculate it. purely based on inflation, it's about $14 million. However, if you
that's absurd.
If you scale it to GDP, like the GDP of the U.S., like how much, what proportion of the federal budget that would have been at the time, it's easily over $300 million in today's money. So that would be as if, you know, Elon Musk, for example, just gave $300 million to the federal government.
That sounds like something he might do.
What planet are you living on? but yeah, so again, depends how you calculate it. No matter what, a ton of money to just be handed to the United States. And as Congress does, it argued about how to use it for 8 years. Because there, the way the will was worded left some things to interpretation. And then through a calamity of errors, Congress, for some reason, decided to invest the money in bonds issued by the state of Arkansas, which defaulted on the bonds basically immediately.
I mean, that, you know, Arkansas.
Yeah. And so, former president, and at the time, congressman, so he was a congressman after he was president.
JQ?
JQA. Yep, JQ. Well, yes.
Yeah!
John Quincy Adams convinced the rest of Congress to recoup the money with interest and got it set aside for its purpose. And in 1846, President James K. Polk signed into law the bill establishing the Smithsonian Institution and set up a trust for it to be funded by the federal government basically indefinitely. This really brings mm-hmm. up John Quincy Adams several notches on my ladder of the coolest presidents. I know nothing else about him, so don't quote me on that.
No, so actually John Quincy Adams is one of the few presidents that you can actually like and like be okay with it. Because he, after he was president, he goes back to Congress, and they had this thing called the gag rule, where you weren't allowed to debate slavery. And so he would just show up and be like, hey, you know how we're not supposed to talk about slavery? Slavery's bad. What are you going to do about it? And he just did that for, like, the rest of his life in Congress, and then he died, the actual legislative building.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. What are you going to do? I was the former president. You're going to tell me what to do? No.
Yeah. Like, he's actually... even though he only serves one term as president, we can kind of like him and not feel too bad about ourselves.
Okay, that does make you feel a little better.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now it is 1846. We have an actual governmental organization called the Smithsonian Institution. It's governed by a board of regents, and the secretary of the Smithsonian that is appointed by... I don't know if that's a presidential appointment or not. It's not like a cabinet position, even though it's called secretary of the... blank. But that's still the case today. Board of Regents, Secretary of the Smithsonian, those positions still exist.
So actually, this is one thing I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
And this is the one thing I wanted to check, is that the head of the Smithsonian is the Chancellor of the Smithsonian, and that has by tradition been held by the Chief Justice of the United States.
Fascinating. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you go...
So John Roberts is in charge of the Smithsonian?
Yeah, so Smithsonian, it is mostly a nominal position at this point. But it is still one of the titles that gets held. If you go to the Smithsonian Institution Wikipedia page, you'll see the chancellor being John Roberts.
Interesting. I did not clock that at all. John Roberts is just such a nothing name that I'm sure I didn't even notice it. interesting. But that's a cool fun fact. I doubt that would not have come up. But yeah, so we're now mid-1800s. Globally, mid-1800s is peak the global north pillaging stuff from the global south. It's when many nations in Europe started to carve up Africa and South America and to an extent Asia into different colonies and steal everyone's stuff. And the U.S. wanted in on that action. In the early 1840s, the U.S. founded, like I said, expeditions all across the world to steal people's stuff. And those... as well as to collect plants and animals, specimens, water samples, minerals, etc. And all of those things got sent to what is now the Smithsonian. the main headquarters of the Smithsonian is called the Castle. That's still a building that was sort of, but that was sort of the initial building. Because before, like I said, it was sort of had a little office in the Capitol building. But now they got its own building. It took a couple of years to build. It was finished being built in 1855. And so that was meant to be the main location of the entire Smithsonian. But very quickly, if you're out pillaging the world, you're going to run out of space. So they ran out of space basically immediately. And these days, the castle is now basically just an administrative building. That's like the headquarters. They don't really have too much of their collections stored there anymore. But yeah, it is still in use on the National Mall today.
Cool.
Did you have something, Fia?
No, I was just thinking. That's cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, so up to this point, we've been talking about sort of the whole organization of the Smithsonian, not just the natural history side. But we'll just do a very, very quick run through of when each of the other various divisions of the Smithsonian were sort of established. So the first one to sort of be spun off was the Arts and Industries Building, which opened in 1881. So over 40 years after the Smithsonian, or almost 40 years after the Smithsonian was established itself. Congress got a little preoccupied for a little while in the 1860s and 70s, but got back to civil works in the 1880s. The National Zoo got its own dedicated division in 1889 as the collection of, you know, live animals sort of kept ballooning, and the zoo was originally designed by the same person who designed Central Park in New York City, among many other things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's a very famous architect from the late 1800s. The National Museum, the one we're talking about for the rest of the episode, split off in 1910. The Museum of American History in 1964, National Art Gallery and Smithsonian American Art Museum in 68, National Air and Space Museum in 76, which makes sense because you need to have been to space to have a space museum, presumably. the National Museum of African Art in 1987.
That's what they want you to believe.
Yeah, that's what they want you to believe. Museum of African Art in 87, Postal Museum in 93, Museum of the American nice. Indian in 2004. Museum of African American History and Culture in 2016. National Museum of the American Latino and Smithsonian American Women's History Museum, TBD. Both of those are being planned and have been greenlit. There's currently being worked on. They're not open yet. So there's just a lot of stuff happening still to this day at the Smithsonian. Like I said, like a good quarter of that list happened since 2000, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So finally, onto just the National Museum of Natural History. I'm for the rest of this, when I say Smithsonian, I'm referring to the Natural History Museum. They're kind of interchangeable from this point on. So the Natural History side split off and became its own thing in 1910. It was originally not just the natural history stuff, though, but a general museum that included the natural history, but also regular history, American history, things like that, art, culture, and other topics that the Smithsonian had in their collections. Basically, this was just the collections moving from the main building, the castle, to a building dedicated as a standalone museum. That's basically what this was. They just put all their collections in a separate building and called it a different division. Various directors of the museum had been begging for more space, as museums kind of always are. So they've been asking for that since 1886, didn't get congressional approval until 1903. So it took them quite a while, as you know, Congress. Even back then, it takes a while to do kind of anything.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I thought this was a very fun fact. At one point during the construction of this building, they stopped construction because the architects were going with this very fancy French Baroque style, and the red-blooded Americans in the Smithsonian said, get that French garbage out of here. And they made the architects redesign the building in a much more simple and more like Roman-inspired style.
Oh my gosh.
very American to just sort of be kind of inclined to dump on the French.
Always.
Always.
And it cost, ballpark, in today's dollars, about $115 million, which is a heck of a deal. to build a 1.5 million square foot building for $115 million in 2024 is insane. That'd be close to a $1 billion building.
Wow.
Yeah, so when the collection started to move over in 1909, when the building was mostly done, they only had about 10 million specimens total, which is still a lot, but not even 10% of the current total. So most of the collections have been, you know, collected since the museum split off and moved to its current building. During World War I, the building was actually taken over by the Bureau of War Risk Insurance, which I had never heard of. Do you have any insights on that, Mike? I did look up what it is, but have you ever heard of that?
Can you say it one more time for me?
The Bureau of War Risk Insurance.
I mean, like, I could take some guesses based on the name, but you should just, like, go for it.
Yeah. So it's basically, it insured non-military cargo vessels for losses by acts of war. So, like, during World War I, if, like, the German army decided to sink an American just regular cargo ship, they'd be insured for that. So that...
Well, that was nice of them.
Yeah. So that bureau took over the building for their administrative stuff, and the museum was closed during World War I and reopened in 1919. Over the decades, as their collections continued to sort of amass, as you do when you're pillaging the world, in 1930, they asked Congress for more money for more space, which did get approved when they asked for it. But in 1930, the U.S. government had bigger things to worry about, like an unemployment rate of over 20%. So even though...
And what do we call that period of time, Gavin?
That's the Great Depression, baby. So even though for whatever reason Congress did approve it at the time, they didn't actually get the money for that until 1960. And so at that time, once the money started to flow, two new wings of the building were completed in 1965. In 57 through 64, the Natural History Collection sort of got split off from the rest of the collection. So up until the late 50s, early 60s, all of their collections were still under the same division in this building. Natural history, American history, culture, art, whatever. But throughout this, late 50s, early 60s, they started to sort of splinter off into their own things. So the first one established the National Museum of Natural History, the same one that we still talk about today. And the first one to spin off was the National Museum of American History. And then the various art museums were spun off throughout the rest of the 60s. In the 80s, the museum was once again about to run out of space. But since DC is a very compact city already, and it's not like they
can... so much you can do, yeah.
Yeah, and especially with DC being weird like it is, you can't really expand DC itself out into, like, the surrounding states. It then becomes other cities. So they bought and built a facility in Maryland to house some research labs and some collections, and that opened in 1983. Throughout the rest of the 80s through the early 2000s, there was a lot of turnover in leadership at the Natural History Museum as funding kind of dried up under a certain president in the 1980s. it's Ronald Reagan, for anyone not familiar. And the museum sort of struggled. So there was that. And then the museum sort of struggled to just sort of set goals for itself to meet because they're so unsure about funding. It's kind of hard to set goals for yourself when you don't know exactly how much money you're going to have year over year. And with Reagan slashing budgets left and right, it was pretty unpredictable. But that sort of leadership, you know, stuff continued throughout the early 2000s. In 2003, though, a guy named Christian Samper, he was a dual citizen between the U.S. and Colombia, was appointed as director of the museum, and he was, by all accounts, an excellent fundraiser. He raised over $100 million to renovate the Hall of Mammals, over $60 million for the Hall of Oceans, over $1 million for the National Precious Gem Collections, which is also in the museum. He also ran the Smithsonian Tropical Institute, which is the program that Liz went to Panama for.
Cool.
In 2007, he was appointed as the Secretary of the Smithsonian, so overseeing the whole institution, all of the museums. However, just 2 months later, after he became head of the whole shebang, he was accused of basically injecting politics into the operations of the Natural History Museum when he was the director of it.
Ooh.
In 2005, they were building a new exhibit about the Arctic. And basically he was accused of stepping in to sow doubt and underplay human impacts of climate change to appease climate deniers in Congress and the George W. Bush administration. So, eventually, in 2008, so a year after he was made, in charge of everything, he did resign after people from various scientific agencies like NOAA, like National Science Foundation, places like that, basically came out and said, like, yeah, he asked us for, like, information about things to include in the exhibit, and we definitely got the vibe that he was trying to tone down the language.
Yikes.
Yeah, specifically about humans causing climate change. There was also a weird thing with him greenlighting a donation from a petroleum lobbying group to go toward the Hall of Oceans.
When was all this happening again?
Like 2005 or so.
Has any of this been reversed in the years since?
Oh, yeah. Or... like they...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I don't remember seeing anything that I would find fishy when I went there a year ago. And so the donation from that petroleum group was later withdrawn after the Board of Regents were like, this might be a conflict of interest on somebody's part here.
Yeah.
So then the petroleum group was like, we're good. We don't want it. We don't want to give you money. Since then, things have honestly been real exciting with the museum. They've had various expansions and renovations. They expanded the Hall of Human Origins, which is incredible. They have a thing that takes a picture of your face, and you can pick like which species on the human evolution timeline, and it'll like transform your face into like what that your ancient great times like a several thousand ancestors. It was very hard for me because of my beard. It did not like that. It made it really weird, but it was very fun to see Liz as Liz came with me on that trip. To see Liz as like Homo ergaster or Australopithecus and stuff like that. Those renovations to the fossil hall that I mentioned, those were just completed in 2019, including a brand new full-size, like 80% complete Tyrannosaurus, which they got on loan from the Museum of the Rockies in Montana. They also got a new setting for the Hope Diamond, one of the largest diamonds in the world. That's also in the museum.
I'm not a big diamond guy, but I've seen that. It is.
It's cool.
It's a giant rock.
It's
like that's a nice rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. So with all that said, ending off the episode here, nothing can be completely good. As much as I love all the research I've done about the Smithsonian, how cool I think it is. As with any large museum in the global north, the Smithsonian's stolen a lot of stuff from around the world. Though generally, they seem to have been better about returning these items than many of their peers. That said, there's still lots of skeletons, particularly of Native Americans, that have not been repatriated yet, seemingly because they don't know where they came from.
Oh.
Not a great way to treat people's bodies.
Yeah.
But also, like to play devil's advocate for just a minute here, let's say they were like, okay, yes, we would like to okay, where do they send them?
And that's totally fair. The ones that they had information on, most of them have been returned.
Okay.
But they do have like they, the Smithsonian has its own human remains task force dedicated to returning these people to their families. There's still around 1,500 skeletons that need to be returned on top of all the cultural stuff that was stolen.
Wow.
Yeah. They're very transparent about it on their website. They have several different web pages dedicated to like, yes, this is a big problem. We know it's a big problem. Here's what we're doing to solve it. And then lastly, because I did mention some of their peers. For comparison to some of the other large museums in the country, the University of California Museum in Berkeley. So I think it was like, let me rephrase that. So the Smithsonian has returned like most of its identifiable human remains. So like meant like 70% or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't actually find it on the website that I'm getting these following numbers from. University of California Museum in Berkeley has only returned or only made available for return 59% of their Native American remains. So it's like, hey, they've contacted the tribe and said, hey, we have a person that was stolen from your land. Do you want it? So 59% of their human remains.
Mm-hmm.
The American Museum in New York, only 47%. The LA County Museum in Los Angeles, only 34%. The Illinois State Museum, only 3%. And finally, the Cincinnati Museum of Natural History and Science, which is where I just was a couple of months ago when I went for a paleontology conference. We had a whole episode about that. That museum in Cincinnati, only 0.3% of their Native American human remains have been offered to be returned.
That seems like not quite as high as it should be.
Yeah. And granted, in terms of like sheer volume, like they have like 500 or so human remains. But that's what, four people that they've offered to return?
Uh-huh.
Not great. All of this data that I just read from is from some incredible reporting from ProPublica. There'll be a link to that where you can search your own local museum to see if they have any literal skeletons in their closet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I'll have a link to that down in the show notes. So if you want to check your local museum, maybe shoot them an email and be like, hey, return those human beings to their families, please.
Yeah.
Please do that. Mm-hmm. Fia, University of Florida has more than they should.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, so that'll be in the show notes. But all things considered, like I said, Smithsonian doing a better job than most of their peers at that. Which does make me feel kind of better that they still have 1,500 skeletons.
But only kind of.
Only kind of, yeah. So that's the Smithsonian. Really cool. So many questions that I still would like answered about how the money happened. But yeah, that's for...
There will be questions for another time.
Yeah, that's for somebody to figure out in like their master's thesis or maybe some really cool investigative journalism somewhere.
Yep.
Yeah. Wonderful. And is that all we have for today?
That's all I got.
Awesome. Well, this has been our episode on the Smithsonian of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike. That was Gavin and Fia, and we hope to see all of you guys for our next episode. Take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Finella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.